Dear friends, most welcome to this seminar on what role for the Africa Development Bank in the New Africa. It's based on a newly released study by the expert group on aid studies, the ADB, ready to face the challenges of a changing Africa. Let me just mention a few words about the expert group. The group was commissioned or formed a year and a half ago. In 2013, actually, it was decided to set up this group that is now studying and analyzing Swedish development cooperation in the idea to contribute to a reformed or develop new aid policies. We do that in an independent way by commissioning studies of experts and researchers, and the researchers and experts are responsible for the outcome, for their own substance and writings in those volumes. At the same time, the expert group is, of course, doing the quality control and also deciding to publish and to launch the reports. And the report, as of today, is the fourth report of the expert group that I think there should be copies. Yes, there are copies afterwards. You can have a look at them. We have a very distinguished panel today. First and foremost, of course, the author himself, Dr. Chris Humphreys from University of Zurich and in Switzerland. And he has a background in studying international financial institutions or development banks. And he has a PhD from London School of Economics. Later on, we will have comments from Dr. Nyunguna Ndungu, who until just a few weeks ago was Central Bank Governor of Kenya. So I think you will have the perspective of a borrower and also a shareholder of the bank. And Dr. Ndungu has also been at the Africa Economic Research Consortium as well as University of Nairobi. And as a connection to Sweden, you earned your PhD from University of Gothenburg in the early 90s. Second to comment on the report is Anders Borg, who is chair of Global Financial Systems Initiative in the World Economic Forum, and as you know, former finance minister in Sweden. He's also nowadays deputy chairman at Kinnevik and Millicom. We will continue with comments from Ulrika Moder, State Secretary for International Development Cooperation and Minister of Foreign Affairs here in Sweden, and as a background, Head of Environment and Foreign Policy at the Green Party, and also a policy at Diakonia, and you have also Africa experience from Mozambique. And finally, Anna Riott, Managing Director from Swedfund, and dealing mainly, of course, and we will listen to Anna on private sector issues. And your background is also with as a Secretary General of the SOS Children's Villages in Sweden, and also with UNICEF in Sweden. Finally, Lars Eikensten, chair of our expert group, will make some concluding remarks. And Lars is today the CEO of Nobel Foundation and a former central bank governor here at Sveriges Riksbank. Next doors. So, some background. Africa, as we know, is in a huge transition. I claim that if you have an image nowadays of Africa, it should not be a woman wearing rural water in a rural area, if they still exist. But more and more, you have shopping malls, IT-based solutions, etc. That is the new emerging Africa that I think we should face also, as well as the role of women, of course. 7 out of the 10 fastest-growing economies we know as of today are in Africa, Africa continent. The macroeconomic framework has improved dramatically over the last 20 years, as well as access to international capital. Nowadays, a number of countries access capital on the capital markets compared to what it used to be during the debt hippie days in the 90s. So the issue and the question today that we're going to discuss, what role should the institution like ADB, Africa Development, play in that context with the new emerging Africa? And we will also look into what role could Sweden and should Sweden play in relation to ADB as well as the emerging Africa? What role does aid have both in Africa but also in relation to an institution like Africa Development Bank? So, to finalize, I think there are 4 different dimensions of the Africa Development Bank that we could discuss today. ADB, as part of the emerging Africa, what role should it play in the role of the new setup of financial institutions and also possibilities? Second, what is the role for a borrower? Third, for a shareholder and an ODA provider, aid provider. And finally, what role does the private sector play and how to relate emerging Africa with the private sector and also Swedish interest in that? So that is a context. I will now invite Dr. Chris Humphries to give us an overview of the outcome and the ideas that he proposed in this very interesting volume on Africa Development Bank in the future.
So thanks to all of you for attending today. Thanks also to the expert group for aid studies for organizing this event and supporting the paper. And thanks especially to the reference group from the EBA who worked with me for several months and gave me very extensive and detailed feedback on the paper and very much strengthened it as a result. So I appreciate that very much. Just a brief overview of what I'm going to speak about today. I'm not going to speak about all the details in the paper. You'll be glad to hear. There's a lot in it. I'm going to instead try to hit some of the main points to give you a flavor of where the report is going and also to perhaps feed into a broader discussion afterwards with the panelists who are going to be also speaking today about Africa and about development aid more generally. Just to give you a sense of my background, I did some work as a consultant mainly on operations in the World Bank and the African Development Bank, so I have some practical practitioner experience. And I've also done a lot of research comparing different development institutions around the world. That's kind of my background, it's very comparative, which could provide some perspective. A lot of these institutions, not just the African Bank, but many of them are going through changes and facing how to deal with an evolving global economy and what's their role in it. So hopefully that can bring some additional useful perspective. A little bit of context, Africa Rising, as Torgne alluded to earlier. This is a story that's been in the media a lot in recent years. Certainly the macroeconomic numbers have been a step up from what they were in previous decades, and you can see this in many different areas, GDP and GDP per capita here, as well as investment rates into the region, public finances, certainly a long ways to go still, but the indicators have generally been a step up from what they were in previous decades, so that's rather positive. But at the same time, of course, there's huge development needs. It's not totally clear that these macroeconomic improvements, that the human development improvements have gone at the same rate. This is the Human Development Index, which, as I'm sure many of you know, comprises a bunch of indicators about life expectancy, education, and income, to simplify a little bit. And Africa is clearly the farthest behind of all the regions in the world. Improved considerably in recent years, but still lagging far behind. And you can also see this in all sorts of other indicators like access to basic health services, human and physical, and economic security, and poverty rates. It's still one-third of the world's extreme poor are in sub-Saharan Africa, and 40% of the continent's population, more than 400 million people, live on less than $1.25 a day. So there's clearly a long way to go. So Africa's rising, Africa's stagnating, Africa's changing at the end of the day in different ways and in different places and at different rhythms. It's a huge continent, of course. It's difficult to generalize about. But it does seem clear that growth is accelerating. This is the last region of the world that hasn't really taken off in terms of growth in a way that Latin America and East Asia have in recent years, for example. And it seems to be happening, but the question is, what kind of shape will it take? Is this going to be an inclusive growth that everyone's going to benefit from, equitable, or is it going to be more exclusive and benefiting only a small portion of the population? That remains to be seen. But what's clear is there's a massive population boom underway right now. The population of the continent is expected to double by 2050 to 2.4 billion people. 20 million or more people each year for the next 35 years are going to be coming onto the workforce looking for job opportunities. And that can be an amazing catalyst for growth and development if all that energy and employment can be channeled in a productive way. But it can also be a catalyst for social unrest, conflict, and migration if it doesn't find a good outlet for it. And it's not so clear where the drivers of this employment growth to make the most of these people coming onto the labor force, where it's going to come from. Because a lot of the economic growth in Africa in recent years has been based on commodities, natural resource extraction, which is certainly beneficial, but it has a lot of potential drawbacks, as many of the experiences in many countries have shown. And it doesn't create so many jobs in relative terms. It's very capital intensive. So where are the jobs going to come from? It's not so obvious yet. Are the governments going to be able to use this natural resource wealth that's coming into their coffers right now in productive ways to stimulate agriculture, light industry, trade between regions within Africa instead of just trade between Africa and the rest of the world? A lot needs to be in place for that to happen. There's huge infrastructure gaps in the region, which I talk about, give some numbers in the paper. Transport infrastructure, energy supply, massive needs if the jobs are going to be created to make the most of this new labor force coming on. Of course, human capital needs as well, investments in human capital. So a lot of investment needs. There's a lot of new players now operating in Africa in external finance. The Chinese are sort of the most well-known, but also a lot of Indian investment. Brazil's Development Bank has now opened an office in South Africa. Turkey, the Middle Eastern countries, are also increasingly engaged. There's new multilateral players like the BRICS Bank, which might happen soon. It's already been agreed upon, although it's not up and running yet. But they expect to work considerably in Africa. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, set up to deal with the post-communist countries in Europe, is actually now ramping up its lending operations in Africa, Northern Africa, which is an interesting development for many reasons, but it's certainly a new player on the scene. The Islamic Development Bank is increasing its investment in the region. There's a series of small, or not so small, sub-regional banks, like the West African Development Bank and the East African Development Bank and the PTA Bank in Southern Africa. These are all multilaterals that are smaller, but growing very rapidly and with very big plans for expansion in the future. And as Torgne alluded to, access to bond markets has increased dramatically, both sovereigns, borrowers, as well as private companies. Not only the euro bond market, which is what gets all the headlines, but also domestic, incipient domestic capital markets in the region. So there's a lot of movement there, but the gaps in terms of investment are massive, and there's clearly still a role for other multilateral players, especially as a way to channel other external investment that wants to be there. Pension funds, big investment funds from outside the region would love to find a way to invest if they can manage the risks, and the development banks can play a very important role in doing that. So let's turn now to the African Development Bank itself. Just very quickly, and I apologize for boring people here who already know this, but I just want to explain the difference between the market-based lending and the concessional lending, because it's kind of important for my paper as a whole. The market-based lending, non-concessional lending, is sort of the basis of the multilateral development bank model. This is the great strength of the bank. Shareholders contribute some capital to start up a bank, and then the bank can borrow on capital markets at very good financial terms and tack on their administrative costs and then still lend to borrowers for development purposes and be able to cover their administrative costs and still lend at attractive rates. So it's generally a self-financing model, which is very attractive to governments, as you can imagine. One of the reasons why development banks are still so popular, why the BRICS Bank has been created, why the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is now being created, because it's a very powerful financial model. The concessional lending window is only in a few development banks, and it's meant for the low-income countries that are perceived not to be able to afford the market-based rates. So they make no-interest loans or even grants, depending on the country, and that's not financially self-sustaining. Governments have to contribute to that, like Sweden, like other governments. There's donation rounds every few years to replenish these lending windows. So now that we have that background out of the way, you can see where the African Development Bank stands up compared to some of the other multilaterals around the world. Relatively small, but at the same time, if you look within Africa itself, it's one of the largest multilateral players out there. So the topic of my paper, as I said, excuse me for a second. That's what happens when you take a drink, I guess. Huh? There we go. Wow, that's a little weird. Okay. The non-concessional window is sometimes overlooked, I would say, when it comes to the African Development Bank by external actors interested in aid. because there's an understandable focus on the poorest countries, the fragile states, the lowest income countries. But I would argue, for a number of reasons, that the non-concessional window is just as important and needs to be strong, especially going forward for the African Bank. The shareholders agree, including Sweden. The bank was given an increase in its capital in 2010 with the idea, on the one hand, to deal with the effects of the financial crisis that had just happened, but on the other hand, to prepare the bank for increasing its lending going forward as the region grows, to be able to fund the kinds of big projects that middle-income countries need. And so capital was increased to expand operational capacity, and when they did so, they projected, the shareholders projected, the kind of lending they were expecting in the years going forward. And the column on the left shows the projections, and the column in bold shows the actual lending commitments for a given year. And as you can see, in the last couple of years, the African Development Bank has fallen well short of expectations. And there's a lot of reasons for that that we're going to talk about a little bit in the course of the presentation. This is somehow another way of looking at the same issue. This is looking at the equity of different development banks and the amount of loans they have based on that equity. The equity is the shareholder capital plus financial reserves, basically. And that defines how much lending a bank can do. And as you can see, for the African Development Bank, they're sitting on a lot of capital that's not being used. Even compared to the other development banks, almost twice as much capital sitting at the African Bank not being used as at the World Bank. That's a major, I wouldn't say it's a waste of resources, but they're not being used. It's resources that could be being used out there to fill these development needs in Africa. And it's borderline criminal that they're not being used. They're just sitting there at the moment for a lot of reasons that we'll talk about. And that's even compared to private finance. It's much more conservative than private financial institutions, as you can see on the right there. And there's a lot of reasons why one might say that all the development banks could actually increase the way they use their capital. But even if you don't buy that argument, even just amongst the development banks themselves, the African Development Bank stands out for not using its capital. Why this matters, I talk about this in a bit more detail in the paper, but just briefly, this concessional, non-concessional window was set up for the benefit of its members, by African countries amongst others. And there's right now a number of countries that could be borrowing from this non-concessional window, like South Africa, Botswana, Algeria, Mauritius, that aren't borrowing from it. They have room, they could borrow, but they're not. And there's reasons for that that we'll talk about. And then there's other countries that would like to be borrowing from this window but can't for a number of other reasons that we'll talk about. So it's clearly not serving its members right now, and that's a problem. A second reason why it matters is that I think people often look at the two lending windows of these banks and think of them as separate sort of institutions, but in fact there's a lot of overlap between them. And two very important overlaps that I want to mention here are the financial overlap. When the banks lend on their non-concessional window, they earn net income every year, and a portion of that net income then is allocated, in the case of the African Bank, to its concessional window. So the middle-income countries are in effect helping subsidize the lower-income countries, so there's a direct financial link there that's important. And secondly, the knowledge transfer aspect of these multilateral banks. That's perhaps, apart from their finance, it's their most important attribute. They're able to bring in experiences, technical assistance from other parts of the world to help countries do projects better than they might have otherwise. And a lot of those best knowledge transfer experiences happen between the middle-income countries and the lower-income countries. That's what the World Bank excels at. It takes experiences from countries that have faced these problems and helps countries that are facing them now. And if a bank is not working with the middle-income countries, it's only working with the poorer countries, then it's losing its ability to do this kind of knowledge transfer, which is a major loss, I would argue. And more broadly, clearly the future, apart from right now, the future of the bank and of Africa is going more towards non-concessional lending. This is, as I mentioned before, the strength of the multilateral development bank model. It takes a small amount of capital, and it can leverage much more lending based on that capital by borrowing. The concessional window doesn't have that. The concessional window needs budget allocations every few years, and those are increasingly difficult to come by, I would say, for many reasons that you all, I'm sure, know. And as these countries move into middle income status, they're all going to be graduating as well. So this is clearly where the bank is going to go. And it needs to have a strong non-concessional window right now as well, I would say. So now to look at some of the reasons why the lending is not where it was predicted by the shareholders. Two sets. One is a set of business practice issues that I want to talk about, and the other is a set of financial policies, just briefly. Business practices, bureaucracy. This is the amount of time it takes to get a loan approved. At the African Bank, 13 months from the beginning of a discussion about a project to when the board of executive directors approves the loan. Something like 20 levels of review that each project has to go through. Four or five country missions, very expensive country missions that use up a lot of time, both on the staff and on the government officials themselves who have to receive these country missions. Translations, reviewing documents, sending documents 2 weeks ahead of time so they can be ready for the meeting. These things take up a huge amount of time. All the safeguards, which is a major issue, rather dear to my heart, actually, a very interesting issue. So there's a lot of procedures that the banks have to go through to approve a loan. And then there's a whole other set of procedures beyond this to actually get the money out the door. So a country could easily wait 2.5 years from the beginning to when it actually first starts getting money. And as you can imagine, a lot of borrowers find that completely unacceptable. Private sector borrowers for sure find that unacceptable for obvious reasons, but public sector borrowers as well. These are projects that have very important potential economic impacts, so there's a real opportunity cost of having to wait that long to get the project started. So it might come as no surprise that many countries are willing to spend much higher interest rates without getting some of the quality control that they might get with the African Development Bank, and just take a loan from the Chinese or issue a bond, for example. So the African Development Bank is sort of not having a seat at the table because, in part, of these bureaucratic hassles. And there's some very understandable reasons why they're in place, mainly from the non-borrowing shareholders. They want to put in quality control. But the way that it's done at the African Bank and some of the other banks is a very rigid, ex-ante, kind of legalistic, check-all-the-boxes kind of way to go about it. And that leaves a staff that's very risk-averse, doesn't want to take chances, doesn't want to innovate, and development is complicated. You need to take chances and try to innovate, try new things, have them fail, and learn from your mistakes. And that's not really possible with the system that's in place now. It's changing in some of the banks. The Inter-American Development Bank has been very successful in improving its procedures, as has the IFC, which I don't have on here. The Asian Development Bank just went through a big reform, and it should. That was the 2012 numbers. It's probably a lot faster now. The World Bank hasn't been so successful, actually, but I would argue that that's not exactly something that should give the African Development Bank comfort, because that shouldn't be the benchmark. And also because the World Bank has some other attributes that sometimes, in the eyes of borrowers, makes up for this bureaucratic hassle. They have an incredible base of knowledge that they can transfer to countries, and countries find that very valuable. I did something like 100 interviews in Latin America of government officials in 10 different countries, and they all emphasized how important it was, the knowledge, value added, the technical assistance that they get from the World Bank loans, and how useful that was for them. The Chinese have $4 trillion in the bank. They don't need money from the World Bank. But they still take loans from the World Bank specifically to get the technical assistance and the knowledge value added. They see it as useful. It's a tool. It's a cooperative bank. They're a member. Why not use it? And the African Development Bank falls very far short in that area. Their own internal studies, as well as client surveys, show that their research work, their ESW, as you call it, within the banking system, tends to be academic-type reports that are a bit detached from the operational reality. They're too long. They're not very concise, policy-oriented type studies. And the African Bank clearly needs to step up its game in that area. If it's just pushing money out the door, that's not going to be very useful to a lot of countries. And another area that the World Bank excels at is innovation in financial instruments. A lot of creativity with coming up with new types of instruments that countries can find useful. Guarantees, syndication, all sorts of new techniques. And the African Development Bank has been very far behind in that area. It says it's got a lot of these policies in place, but it really has not been able to move past this old style, public sector, long-term loan mentality. For a lot of reasons, human resource issues, sort of organizational culture issues, but it needs to improve in that regard. Because it needs to be a packager. I mean, as we spoke about a bit earlier, these projects that are happening now, especially in the middle-income countries, are big. They need a lot of money. The Chinese lent $3 billion in a single loan to Ghana a couple years back, $3 billion in one loan. That was more than the African Bank lent in its entire year in non-concessional lending all around the continent. These are the kind of resources that these countries are looking for these big projects. And the World Bank, or sorry, the African Bank kind of needs to rethink itself and become more of a packager, a catalyst to bringing in other resources along with its loans. And it hasn't really been able to do that yet. Turning to financial policies, the credit policy is what defines which countries can borrow from which lending window. Back in the 1990s, the African Bank went through a lot of problems because of debt issues amongst its member countries. And it was thought at the time by a bunch of shareholders that the bank should take on the same credit policy as the World Bank, which in the case of the African Bank most recently led to only 14 countries out of 54 being able to borrow from the non-concessional window. The rest had to borrow from the concessional window, 40-something countries. And that might have made sense in the 1990s, but I would argue that it makes less sense now. This is a list of countries that have issued bonds, I think almost exclusively in the Eurobond market in the last couple of years. These are all concessional borrowing countries. So they're being told that they're not allowed to borrow from the non-concessional window, which is at an interest rate of about 1% for about 20 years with a grace period. And instead, they're being told by the IMF that it's okay to issue at 5, 6, 7, 8% to borrow at 10 years. And that seems a bit absurd. When the African Development Bank's non-concessional window has a lot of capital, it's not being used, and these countries are having to pay much higher interest rates than they would otherwise. And these are countries that just went through debt relief. And so we're encouraging them to stock up foreign debt when instead the bank that's their cooperative bank could be lending to them. And shareholders, to their credit, recognize this and have changed the policy back in last May. They've opened it up a little bit to allow some concessional countries to access the non-concessional window, but only under very specific circumstances. And there's a lot of nervousness within the African Bank's treasury about this because they're worried about the way the credit markets perceive them. They're worried about losing their AAA status. So they've been going a little bit slowly on that. And I'd like to talk about that AAA status as the second of my slides on financial policy. This is something that seems kind of a sacred cow in the African Development Bank. Nobody questions that they need to be AAA. And I would argue that perhaps they could have a lot more operational flexibility if they weren't AAA and still be serving their members. Because this need to hold on to the AAA status, which they've almost lost, by the way. The African Bank was downgraded on its standalone credit ratio. In other words, the ratings agencies look at the bank on how it operates just in terms of its own finances and rates it. And then it gives it an increase based on its shareholder support. And right now, the African Development Bank is just a step away from losing its AAA status, even with shareholder support. So they're very nervous there for a bunch of different reasons. The portfolio of the bank, the African Development Bank, is seen as very heavily concentrated, and it's concentrated in a few countries that are perceived as risky, especially northern African countries, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco. These countries would love to borrow more from the African Bank, and the African Bank has all this money that's sitting there waiting to be lent, but they can't because they're worried about the concentration risk and the way the markets will perceive them. So they have these member countries that are desperately in need, and they've got the money, but they can't help them. And that seems like a bad outcome. As well, it limits their ability to open up to the concessional borrowing countries, as we just spoke about in the last slide, because they're worried about the risks. And similarly with private sector lending, which has increased a lot at the African Development Bank in recent years, as the shareholders have requested, but it's perceived as more risky. So they have to watch out going into private sector lending more because they're afraid of losing their AAA rating. And I would suggest that the bank could pragmatically consider downgrading as part of a calculated plan to increase its operational capacity in all these ways that I've mentioned, pre-announced. It would certainly increase loan costs somewhat, but it's not clear how much. If it gets downgraded by one or two steps, maybe 50, 100 basis points, that's hypothetical, of course. But there's clear, I mean, African countries are paying 8, 9% interest rates. So going from 1% to 2%, it seems like there's still going to be borrowers out there for this money. And an example that I point out a lot that I've done a bit of research on, thank you, is the Andean Development Corporation in Latin America. This was a bank set up by borrowers only back in 1970. So it doesn't have a AAA rating because it doesn't have the industrialized countries behind it. At the moment, it's got a AA minus rating. And it's lending in Latin America, which has much better access to finance than Africa. And even at that AA minus rating, three steps below the African bank, in a region that has better access to finance, it's still lending more than $12 billion a year compared to only $3 billion by the African Development Bank. So they're clearly doing something right. It's possible to have a viable development bank without a AAA rating. Part of the reason CAF is able to be so successful is even though its prices are a little high, it has a lot of operational attributes that are very attractive to borrowers. It's extremely fast, extremely flexible, extremely adaptable, all things that the African Bank needs to go towards. And partly it can do that, CAF can, because of its governance arrangements. It's only got borrowers backing it. It doesn't have non-borrowing countries, which leads to some tensions, shall we say, within the governance of banks. I point out three ways that the African Bank sort of needs to change for the future. Taking more risks, being able to take more risks, being able to innovate financially, and being more flexible and demand-driven. These are all, everyone agrees with this, right? I mean, this is maybe even a little bit obvious. Everyone knows this, the staff of the bank know this, but it's not so easy to change because of the governance situation. And this is what my research has shown me in many banks around the world. You look at these technical issues, these operational policies, but underneath a lot of this lies governance and tensions between different groups of shareholders. And I would suggest that the African Bank is not going to be able to make the changes that I'm suggesting or other changes until it develops a shared vision amongst the shareholders on where they want the bank to go. And with that, I will conclude. Thank you very much. Thank you.